And WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Some days, the challenges facing the world's superpower seem overwhelming, even just the problems at home. 42 million Americans with no health insurance, 15 million working Americans living in poverty, 76 million baby boomers on the cusp of an uncertain retirement. Fear not, says our guest tonight, there is a way. Columnist Matthew Miller has a modest proposal: strategically reallocate just 2% of the country's GDP and watch the nation blossom. Tonight on Point, self-help in a national nutshell, the 2% solution. But first, in a significant new step, the Bush administration now says it will introduce a draft UN resolution that would authorize a multinational force in Iraq and encourage Iraqis to set a timetable for holding elections and establishing self-rule. Secretary of State Colin Powell said under the plan, the United States would keep a dominant role in Iraq and would command any United Nations force. But soaring costs appearing to be pushing the Bush administration towards seeking United Nations involvement. Mike Allen covers the White House for The Washington Post. I asked him to explain the administration's shift.
Well, if you listen to the White House, there's no change here. Is their want. They're portraying this as nothing to see here. Move along. A continuation of the UN's vital role is what they're saying. In fact, this is a dramatic reversal. The State Department has been saying for some time that there's no possibility of getting the large numbers of troops without some type of concession to many other countries' desires for some UN imprimatur on the operation. But what occurred was a desperate need for troops. The United States is out. There's no political desire or perhaps ability to commit more. And so I think the administration simply saw the necessity of taking a step that they thought was necessary and they probably didn't want to do at all.
Is it clear exactly what the administration is now open to with the UN in Iraq?
Well, funny that you should ask. What dominated the White House briefing today was the reporter's effort to get the new White House press secretary, Scott McClellan, to show a little leg, to give some indication of what concessions the U.S. might be willing to make. Now, as described by the administration officially, they're not doing anything. They're not changing anything. They described a situation where the UN continues to play the role it has, and yet somehow magically there's additional, a broader international participation. In fact, that's just sort of an early negotiating position, and Secretary Powell said something very interesting and almost surprising at his news conference that he held very hastily this afternoon. It was moved up several hours. The Pentagon, White House, other parts of the administration had saying the U.S. would be in clear control here. He said, certainly the United States will continue to play a dominant role, but a dominant role does not mean the only role. Hmm. Secretary Powell is showing they're open to more U.N. involvement, but I think the reluctance of the administration to acknowledge that indicates how difficult it was for them to get to this position.
And that there will be a negotiation ahead. So the United States needs troops from other countries in Iraq, and they apparently need cash from other countries as well. How far is the administration likely to have to go to get what it needs from the UN? How much control is it likely to have to give up? How much is it likely to have to cede?
Here's how one of my colleagues very astutely described this. He said they want the biggest fig leaf possible for the United Nations at the smallest possible cost. And it's not clear what that is, but there is enough ill will or at least hard feelings from some members of the United Nations Security Council. France has said they want the United Nations to play a central role. So I think some diplomats at the UN today said that where the concessions will come in the role that the UN plays in Iraq's political future, in setting up the Constitutional Convention, in setting up the elections. Now, at the briefing today, I asked Scott McClellan several times whether he would rule out any diminution in the role of the U.S. Civil Administrator there, Paul Bremer. And he didn't really rule it out, but what they're saying is we had envisioned Ambassador Bremer's role diminishing over time anyway, because our longtime stated desire is to turn these functions over to the Iraqi people. So I think that that may be where a lot of the bargaining occurs.
So does this mean that the kind of what we've come to think of as the Rumsfeld-Cheney view of the United States, large and in charge without challenge in Iraq for a long time, is now off the table?
The U.N. Secretary General Kofi Annan has agreed that this force will have a unified command, and it will be the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no question about that on the military side. Now, I think the United States will remain very much large and in charge in other areas as well. But can these other significant players be made to feel that they have a significant role? And that's going to be Secretary Powell's challenge.
Isn't France likely to hold out until it is in fact given some kind of significant role, until the U.S. power is diluted to some degree through the U.N. presence? Wouldn't France sit on its vote waiting for that?
The way that the process has been described to us is that the president told Secretary Powell, consult with the members of the Security Council and see what you can get. So there's not been a formal tabling of this resolution. The administration hasn't actually committed to introducing it. What they said to us was the president authorized Secretary Powell to negotiate about it. So this is what he's going to be working on, but I think they have some sense that there could be success. Certainly, if there were certain failure, they would not have gone ahead with this in this rather public way.
And Mike, what sort of timetable are we looking at here? How urgently does the administration now feel that it needs that greater UN imprimatur and international support?
Well, the president speaks to the United Nations later this month. This is the successor to the September 12th, 2002 speech about Iraq. That serves as a marker. They've not said that they will have this worked out before then in the White House parlance. That would be an artificial timetable. I'm looking at my calendar. I'm like, that's not very artificial. That seems like a clear timetable. But that seems to be what they're shooting for. And it's clear that the president's speech to the United Nations later this month will be framed around whatever progress has been made on this resolution.
So we're likely to hear a lot more about this and fairly soon. Mike Allen, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks a lot, Tom.
Mike Allen is White House reporter for The Washington Post. He spoke with us from Washington. Oh, it sounds like a dream solution. For just 2 cents on the national dollar, our guest tonight, Matthew Miller, says America can fund common sense fixes for all or most that ails the country. A broken health care system, struggling schools, the plight of the working poor. A solution is at hand, he argues, if America, Republicans and Democrats alike, will only see it and commit. So we're thinking positively tonight, hearing out a man with a plan and a 2% solution. Is this it? The key that turns the lock, the new leaf we can all turn over together. Listen closely and let us know. You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from New York is columnist and commentator Matthew Miller. He is the author of The 2% Solution, Fixing America's Problems in Ways Liberals and Conservatives Can Love. He's a former budget aide to the Clinton White House, now reaching out to everybody. Good evening and welcome, Matt Miller.
Thanks very much, Tom. Glad to be here.
It's good to have you. So you're sweeping in with a book that if it were on the personal plane, might be in the self-help aisle, but you're aiming it at the whole country, and you've got a big idea here, Matt Miller. We're happy to see you playing on the big canvas, as the Washington Post says, with your incorrigible wonkery, but it's not all that wonkish. It sounds fairly simple. Take us in. What's the idea?
Well, the basic idea is, suppose I told you that for 2 cents on the national dollar, we could have a country where every American had health coverage, every full-time worker earned a living wage, every poor child had a great teacher in a fixed-up school, and politicians didn't need to spend so much time groveling to wealthy donors. And suppose I added that we would achieve these liberal-sounding goals largely through conservative-sounding means, like tax subsidies for health care, like market-based compensation for teachers, even bigger voucher trials, and that when the dust cleared, government would be smaller than it was when Ronald Reagan was president. Now, my wager is most people would say, well, for 2 cents on the dollar, that sounds intriguing. I'd like to hear more. So then I have to explain 2 cents on the national dollar means 2% of national income, or GDP, which in 2004, the campaign year which I'm pegging this to, is about $220 billion a year. That's orders of magnitude beyond the boundaries of the typical Washington debate. Now, if you listen to the folks who set the terms of that debate, the politicians, the mainstream media, and the way they interact, the usual talking heads you'd see on the tube, they'd say, well, this is impossible. If you listen to common sense, I'm arguing, people will still say, and I have a poll in the book that backs this up, well, if this is 2 cents on the dollar, this is pragmatically doable, these goals for that amount, I'd still like to hear more. So between our proper common sense intuition that 2% is a small number, and the Washington consensus that a 2% shift in national resources and priorities is beyond imagining, lies a chasm in which most of the quote-unquote solutions on offer from all sides amounts to a charade.
They fall into that chasm and they're never seen again. We're going to work real hard tonight to put that kind of a bread-in-the-bone skepticism aside and listen to what you've got to offer here, Matt Miller. Though we know 2% of anything around the American dollar is a lot of money. But still, we're looking out on politics that seems so small-minded so often and so incapable of really sweeping responses to national problems that it becomes intriguing. But I guess my kind of gut response to $220 billion, as big as that is that it sounds like a relatively modest number to do all the fixing up that you seem to be describing.
Well, I don't think so. I mean, most of the if you just add up, just briefly, the sort of big ticket items that get you toward the $220 billion, doing a covering the 40 million-ish uninsured runs about $80 or $85 billion a year. That's on a plan that's modeled after the kind that Bill Bradley had offered in the 2000 presidential primary campaign that's actually not that different than the one President George Bush's father offered back in 1992. People don't realize there was a lot of commonality between those two plans. The second big ticket item is creating a it's kind of a larger version of what's today called the earned income tax credit that provides a wage supplement to the working poor so that we achieve something like a $9 to $10 an hour living minimum wage, not putting the burden fully on employers through a higher minimum wage on their payrolls, but having the federal government subsidize the incomes of low-income workers because we believe there's a decent minimum for people in America who work full-time. That costs about $80 billion or so above the current money spent on the EITC. So we've got
so there's 160, 170 billion right there.
That's right. Then we're going to take $30 billion for a major teacher initiative that I'm calling the Millionaire Teacher Plan. What it means to do, and that's $30 billion, if I can tell you briefly what it is, the biggest problem facing high poverty schools, obviously there's lots of problems that these urban areas face and that the kids face and that a lot of these families, which have lots of problems, face. But if you could wave a magic wand and address one thing, researchers and all the reporting I've done suggest that you would be trying to improve the quality of the teachers in these schools as the key lever, because right now, even the teachers' unions will readily admit that we're recruiting from the bottom third of the college class to staff these schools in these high poverty areas. You know, the quality of the teacher corps used to be subsidized up through the 1960s and 1970s, frankly, through discrimination. Women and minorities in those days didn't have as many opportunities professionally outside the classroom.
So you want to pump up the wages with some federal subsidy or money here that would attract a higher quality teacher to those jobs?
That's true in brief, but it wouldn't just be throwing money, because I would only increase the and we can get into it in more detail if you want later, but I would only increase the wages conditioned on the unions giving up some of the crazy rules they have that makes it likely that the money wouldn't be spent effectively. So that's another 30 there.
So there's 30. So there you're up around 200.
I'm up around 190 or so, okay. And I throw in $10 billion for a federal contribution to make universal preschool, or make preschool universal, which is something that's getting some attention and should. We spend a lot less than other countries, and I don't think people need a lot of chapter and verse on why it's important for especially disadvantaged kids to have the kind of preschool experience that most middle and upper class kids take for granted, and it brings them to school much readier to learn.
And remind me at this point, Matt Miller, are all the Republicans running out of the room screaming?
Well, I urge them not to be. And in my book, you hear the voices of people from the Bush cabinet. You hear conservative icons like Milton Friedman. You hear the Republican Party chairman, Ed Gillespie, all making noises about why this is not an unthinkable idea. The reason being is even if we do all this, and this is the point I made at the beginning, right now the government's spending about 20% of GDP. Under Ronald Reagan, a conservative I can, it spent 22%. We can do these 2 cents and be smaller than Ronald Reagan.
Well, we're thinking big and sweeping and positive tonight with Matt Miller about a modest proposal for fixing just about everything that ails America. He calls it the 2% solution. Are you ready for a big new positive push on the nation's problems? Is this it? Could this be the way? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Modest proposal for fixing just about everything that ails America. My guest is Matthew Miller. His new book is The 2% Solution, Fixing America's Problems in Ways Liberals and Conservatives Can Love. You can join the conversation. What do you think? What do you make of Matt Miller's big idea here? Is the country ready to carve out 2% of GDP annually to fix health care and education and low-wage work and more? Would $220 billion a year fix those problems? If we had it, and if you thought it would work, would you be ready to pay more taxes to support it? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Matt, I want to get into the numbers here a bit further, but I want to ask you, first of all, what are you doing throwing this idea out, and why does it have to come from you, a columnist, a commentator? Is there some structural reason we're not seeing big idea solutions apparently coming more often from American politicians?
I think there is, Tom. I mean, my frustration and what really motivated me to write the book is a frustration with the terms of current debate. I think that on all these issues, it's possible to find grand bargains between left and right, where if the left accepts more market-friendly approaches to the problems and the right agrees to pony up money equal to the size of the problem, you could make deals and make progress. The problem is, in each political party today, you have a kind of ideological and interest group straitjacket that almost systematically bans the expression of common sense blends of the best of liberal and conservative thinking. And so it leaves this void in what I would think would be, I don't know if it's the radical center or the center left or somewhere where there's a kind of solutions gap in public life where both sides end up mouthing pseudo solutions that we know aren't real. That's part of what fuels our disillusionment with politics. And I wanted to put in one place and package under this 2% umbrella the notion that it doesn't take something revolutionary to actually address these problems we think are intractable, but in fact a literally marginal reallocation of resources and attention done in a sensible way, in ways where bargains can be struck between left and right that honors both sides' values. And so that's what really motivated it.
And Matt, what do you think about that? You write about this tyranny of charades you call politics being reduced to, but do you think that American citizens are ready to kind of bust out of that tyranny and glom onto something new? Or has somehow the country become habituated to this to this gridlock? Is there kind of just presumption, well, we're going to be gridlocked perpetually?
I think people feel that way, but I tell you, there were a lot of encouraging signs. First, I commissioned a poll specifically for the book and some focus groups, and I found in the focus group lots of interest in trying to get serious about this stuff, tremendous frustration with the kind of symbolic appeals and empty rhetoric that people feel they're hearing from both sides. The poll showed surprising support, more than I expected, for an agenda that, if we look at it, is more ambitious than anything that's been on the table since before the Clinton health care plan went down a decade ago. I think the problem is there's been a real dysfunction in our national debate since 1994 with the demise of the Clinton health care plan. Since then, Democrats were so scarred by the experience and, of course, the loss of Congress for the first time in 40 years that they have been incredibly timid. They've never felt they've been too scared to ever think big again. The Republicans, emboldened by that Democratic timidity, decided to push much harder on their traditional priorities of cutting taxes and cutting regulations. And so what's been lost in this dysfunctional debate is the notion of two longstanding American ideals, equal opportunity and the commitment to a minimally decent life for citizens of a wealthy nation. And I'm hoping that somehow this book can contribute to rehabilitating what ought to be the center of public discourse. It's not a new left we need. It's a new center. The American political debate needs to be recentered around a series of fundamental goals that all of us can agree on, whether we're Republican or Democrat or independent. I mean, when I talk with people in the book, like Ed Gillespie, chairman of the Republican Party, he'll say, I don't think you'll find any conservatives who don't think that people every citizen shouldn't have basic health coverage. It's the means by which you do it that is the dispute. Now, I want to take him at his word, but then have to challenge him to say, okay, to achieve that, we'll have to give up some of the tax cuts that President Bush has allocated for the best off in our society. But those are the conversations we need to have. The beginning is to agree on these goals that all of us should be able to share and rehabilitate some notion of public ambition during the critical next decade.
Well, you've got some beautiful ideas here, but let's get in and poke around at these numbers. What about it? Does this require tax hikes? Where are you going to come up with $220 billion a year? You talk about Ronald Reagan's 22% of GDP government was using, and of course, we know the deficits that came out of those years. We're now looking at tremendous deficit projections right now. Where do you, Matt Miller, come up with $220 billion more dollars or reallocated dollars a year for this grand plan?
Basically, I do it about half through spending cuts or reallocations of current spending and half through tax increases or repeals in the current Bush tax cuts.
So what are you going to take it away from, and where's the new tax?
On the spending side, right now we're spending about, by different estimates, around $100 billion a year in so-called corporate welfare, anything from farm subsidies to well-off farmers to marketing promotional monies for large corporations that do work overseas. I would like to take out, because I'm being pragmatic, I don't think we can eliminate all of corporate welfare. That's not realistic. But I'm saying let's get rid of a quarter of corporate welfare as we know it. Let the K Street lobbyists say that they've saved 75% of it and bank $25 billion to help fund this plan.
Okay.
I'm talking about right now we spend, through programs like Medicare and Medicaid, we spend about $25 billion a year offering extra help to hospitals and other medical providers who care for disproportionate amounts of uninsured people.
Mm-hmm.
Under my plan, if we're actually going to spend $80 billion or so making sure that everybody has basic health coverage, we no longer need to provide this backdoor backstop of $20 or $25 billion a year to hospitals and providers. They will be upset about that. I mean, make no mistake, every reallocation of money in our system and our budget process causes lots of political screams.
But you're saying get a decent health care system and we won't need that particular subsidy.
Right, because we don't need to give backdoor subsidies to these hospitals if patients are coming in the door with insurance in the first place.
So there's $50 billion. What else have you got to scrape away from?
I will include a new gas tax. I would phase in a 60-cent a gallon gas tax, much like the one that Ross Perot and Paul Tsongas talked about in the early 1990s, which at the time—
60 cents a gallon. So it would be $2.60 a gallon today.
Depending on where people live. That's right, which would still be, and I understand it's not popular. Believe me, what was interesting, Tom, is in my focus groups when I talked about different ways of paying for this stuff, everybody instantly assented and was happy to say, we'll give up whatever the future Bush tax cuts are. I did this before the last round, but after the first round of Bush tax cuts, people didn't expect to get more tax cuts after 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
And when you said, can we postpone those or put those off? They said, oh, sure, we didn't think that's going to happen anyway. But they do moan when you talk about a gas tax. My argument to them, and I think it has to be part of the debate, is that for reasons of national security, for energy policy, if we want to get serious about increasing our fuel efficiency, and for environmental policy, for the same reasons. I mean, how many wars in the Persian Gulf are we going to fight? Basically because we are incredibly reliant on foreign oil, more dependent on foreign oil than we were back at the times of the early oil embargoes and crises. And even after a 60-cent increase in the gas tax, it will leave our prices lower than they were back in the early 1980s, still half as much as high as they are in Europe. And I think it's something that we need to begin to face as a nation, as people like Perot and Tsongas urged a decade ago.
So if your brave new world is attractive enough, maybe people swallow 60 cents a gallon on gas. You're saying give back the Bush tax cuts. And of course, that will hit some people much more heavily than others and wealthier people.
I'm only repealing the sort of top third of the Bush tax cuts to fund this plan.
In other words, just the richest Americans would lose their tax cut, the Bush tax cut.
Correct.
All right. And what else? What other tax have you got in here, Matt Miller?
Right now, when people get health benefits from their employer, that is not taxed to them. It's a benefit that may be worth $10,000 or $12,000, depending on what the coverage is. And the employer is able to deduct that from his expenses. The employer does not need to recognize that as taxable income. That amounts, as analysts on all sides would agree, to about $125 billion a year subsidy for employer-provided care and to us and to we as individuals who get our coverage that way. What I would do, following some proposals that have been floated in Washington before, by the wonkish community, is to say that for those health plans that are more generous than the average plan in the country, that excess portion would be considered taxable income to the individual. My theory is why should we have the federal government subsidize extra health coverage for people who already are being funded for basic health coverage when we have 40 million people who don't have basic coverage at all, use some of that money, recapture it and reallocate it to fund basic health coverage for the other 40 million who are totally out in the cold today, and that's a fair reallocation. That's my case.
All right, so there's the big picture. Bette Miller's 2% solution. Listeners, are we smoking something here? Is this at all realistic? Is it very realistic and high time to try something like it? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Bette Miller, I want to invite in for an economist's reality check on all this, because it's fun to think big and it's fun to think fresh, and we'd like to see it happen. But let's hear what somebody has to say, and not just anyone. We're joined right now by Lawrence Kotlikoff. He's chairman of the economics department at Boston University. Lawrence Kotlikoff, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you.
It's great to have you. You've been listening along with us to Matt Miller's big idea, his big proposal, 2% of GDP and a little handshake across the partisan aisle. And we've got all kinds of glorious new realities in America. How does it fall on your ear, Professor Kotlikoff?
Well, I wish Matt would run for president and be elected. I think he's got a lot of good ideas here, and I encourage everybody to read his book. I think we need some fresh thinking. And I think the other point he's making is that the Republicans and Democrats are kind of talking past each other, and that we really need to focus on the fundamentals and get away from the party labels, because a lot of these conversations are really missing the fundamentals, which are, as Matt is stressing, the need to make sure that poor people have a decent world to live in and are kept healthy.
So we're trying not to get caught up in the details of partisan charade, as Matt has it tonight, and get right down to it and say, okay, we'll consider this. Maybe we'd even shell out a few more bucks. But does it add up to your mind? Would it work?
Well, I think it would work. I mean, I think that he's identifying some revenue sources. If you can get these parties to somehow go for it. I mean, Matt was in the Clinton administration until he resigned because of some of their policies. I think he's the only guy in the Clinton administration that actually had any honor, to tell you the truth. And, the Clinton administration had control of Congress here for a while and didn't get any of this achieved. And now we got these wacky Republicans in there cutting taxes like crazy. And there's these two huge problems that Matt hasn't even addressed, unless maybe it's in the book, but we've got this just... You know, as we know, with these just enormous liabilities from Social Security and Medicare, which are just swamping our fiscal problems, so that.
So we've got a big deficit. But what I want to hear from you, if you can offer it to us, Professor Kotlikoff, is Matt Miller is talking about covering 40 million Americans who need health insurance, fixing failed inner city schools for 10 million. Kids, securing a living wage for 15 million working poor, fixing campaign finance reform, fixing Social Security and Medicare. He's going to do it for $220 billion a year, about half of that scraped out of current spending and about half of it from new taxes or repealed tax cuts. Does that add up?
Well, it's a big amount of money. It's really about 10% of federal spending, and that would require, if we're just going to pay for it with taxes, we'd have to have a 10% tax hike, which people don't seem to be too inclined to have. So for it to really work, for it really to add up, Matt's revenue sources that he's identifying would actually have to come on board. In other words, we'd have to get the corporations to give up a quarter or whatever of their subsidies. Will that happen? I don't know. They seem to have a lot of power in Washington to bribe their way to get these subsidies.
But if it did, would $220 billion turn the key in the lock here?
I think that we could do a lot of good with $200 billion, and that Matt's basically on the right track in terms of his proposals. I think the voucher plans for inner city school, for schools in general, public schools, I think the providing subsidization for people to buy health care, health insurance, these things are obvious needs and obvious solutions. And Matt's God bless him. He's what we need, but we need to get him elected.
Matt Miller, you've got a friend in Lawrence Kotlikoff, the economist here tonight. He's gonna point to the political difficulty, maybe impossibility. He's not going to challenge you too hard on the numbers. Let's turn to our listeners and see what they have to say. Steve's calling from Bristol, Rhode Island. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just want to say that I, too, would vote for Matt if he was running for president. And I'm a TV producer. Anytime he wants to make a program about this or do an expose on all of the pork and all the wasted money that does go to corporations, I'd be his man. One thing that I wanted to point out was I think this is a great program. I think it's a great start for helping people, the working poor especially, and the people who aren't covered in health with health care. Mm. I just want to find out, has he studied the work of the Center for Economic and Social Justice and the work in Washington? And has he ever studied the work of Louis Kelso and Mortimer Adler? Kelso was the man who started the employee stock ownership program that we all enjoy, a lot of us enjoy the benefits from today.
And what are you getting at there, Steve? Are you saying it's not enough to have programs? You want to change the ownership structure of the whole economy?
Well, the point is that there'll always be a widening rich and poor gap because you can never make enough money with just your labor to ever get ahead. You need to own capital, but unfortunately, only people who already own capital can buy it on credit with the earnings that it will someday make.
Steve, we've got it. We hear your enthusiasm for it and also your question. Matt Miller here, you're attracting folks who like to think big, folks thinking about change. And Steve says, why stop with these programs? Let's change the allocation of capital in the United States.
Well, I think he's onto something in terms of the idea of trying to move more toward an ownership society. Obviously, I can't address everything in one book. And I think that the notions of trying to figure out ways to harness or change the paradigm so that there's more opportunity, especially for lower income workers to amass wealth, needs to be part of the Social Security reform debate. And I only sketch that briefly in the book. I mean, Larry Kotlikoff is right about the enormous problem of the $25 trillion in unfunded liabilities we face in these programs in Social Security, Medicare, and other federal pensions.
But are you with boomers. President Bush then saying, let's get everybody in the stock market so they'll be owners of American capital?
No, because that's not – again, that's another – the whole Social Security debate is another situation where we're seeing charades on both sides. Mm-hmm. The discussions about so-called privatization, when they come from the Republican side and from more some different kind of thinking Democrats like Bob Kerry or the late Daniel Patrick Moynihan, mm-hmm. at most we're talking about putting 2% of the current 12% payroll tax into private accounts that people would own and be able to grow themselves. So no one's talking about totally privatizing Social Security. But as part of that reform debate, which is going to have to happen in the next 2 years, I think we should be thinking about ways to, whether it's through that kind of idea or through ways of layering on top of current Social Security, different proposals for savings accounts that can be subsidized partly by the federal government, especially for lower income people who don't earn enough money to put aside savings. We can begin to make those programs engines of wealth creation, and that needs to be part of the discussion. If I can throw one more thought out.
Make it quick.
What's so important, maybe I'll come back to it then, but this next decade before the boomers retire is why it's so important to finish this unfinished progressive agenda on healthcare, schools, et cetera, because once the boomers retire, it's going to be hard to bring new people into the boat if we haven't gotten them in already.
Matt Miller, hold the thought right there. We've got to take a short break. We know what a big overhang that piece of demography is, demographics. We're talking tonight about a modest proposal for fixing just about everything that ails America. My guest is Matt Miller. His new book is The 2% Solution, Fixing America's Problems in Ways Liberals and Conservatives Can Love. Are you ready for a big, new, positive push on the nation's problems? Is this it? Could this be the way? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for this program comes from
OS proposal, not so modest, for fixing just about everything that ails America. My guest tonight is Matt Miller, columnist and commentator, author of The 2% Solution, Fixing America's Problems in Ways Liberals and Conservatives Can Love. We're also joined tonight by Lawrence Kotlikoff, chairman of the economics department at Boston University. You can join the conversation as well. Does this sound real to you or like pie in the sky? Is the country hungry enough, worried enough, optimistic enough to try bold new approaches to national problems? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Bill's calling from Milwaukee. Hi, Bill. You're on the air.
Hi. My question is, I'm a lefty from the 60s, and that's where my solutions are. And as I listen to your guest, I think, well, where's the pain for me? I mean, I love his solutions. I think a 60% gas tax is terrific. So
just 60 cents for now, not percent. But anyway,
I'm sorry, 60 cents gas tax is terrific. But I don't hear him imposing anything on me. And I, in my heart of hearts, I sort of know that the solutions have to come from the center. And I don't feel he's asking much of me as a progressive.
So you're saying, where's the pain for me in this formula? Matt Miller, how about it? With that question comes a note of skepticism here.
Well, I think it's an unusual person who's asking for more of the pain, but I think what other people would say is that I'm giving them enough between the gas tax, between I'm going to tax this fellow's bills if he gets employer-provided health insurance now and it's an above-average generous plan, I will tax a little piece of that. If he's gotten tax cuts from President Bush, if he's in a higher income level, I will repeal some of those.
Bill, is that not pain enough?
That seems like enough for Bill.
Bill, how about it?
I'm self-employed, and I don't make enough money to benefit from what George is doing.
So, but the point is, what do you want? How badly do you want to be whipped here, Bill, before it feels like pain to you? If that's your point.
I want your program to be credible. And I hear you're challenging the Republicans severely, but they're the ones in power.
So what does the left have to give to get to the center here?
Now I get it.
Matt Miller, your program on that front, what's the compromise that progressives who might rally to the idea that you're putting out here, the compromises they have to make?
I think in their view, they'd have to give up a fair amount. I want to achieve universal health coverage by using tax subsidies, not by extending direct government programs.
So no Canadian solution here.
That's right. And the typical argument from the left is that my friends on the left is that that means, you know, a lot of money is going to be skimmed off for marketing and administration by these HMOs. And why are we going to allow private insurance to continue to exist as a business? And I tell my friends on the left, if they learn to look at it as a jobs program, they'll learn to love it.
Okay.
You have to – the teachers unions, the biggest constituency in the Democratic Party that sends more delegates to the Democratic National Convention in the state of California has to give up things that are dear to them. The lockstep pay scale. Mm-hmm. They now defend to the death a pay scale that requires everyone to be paid the same based on their years in the classroom and the degree they earned in school. I'm saying that we're going to have very dramatic differentials in pay. I'm going to give a raise to all urban teachers or high-poverty teachers to start, but then I'm going to give dramatically higher raises and a dramatically higher salary path to the best performers so that we make the best teachers of poor children millionaires over their careers.
So maybe enemies in the teachers' union could be produced here.
They have to give up their traditional practice. I think teachers themselves will love it because it's a big win, because they're all going to get some raise, but they have to be willing to compromise on their traditional salary practices, and they also have to make it a lot easier to fire poor-performing teachers who are now blighting the lives of up to 10% of urban kids, as the union leaders themselves will tell you. So the unions have to give up that. The labor unions are typically the ones who don't like the idea that I would suggest we have to use to fund part of this, which is to tax above-generous plans, healthcare plans, tax a piece of that to help pay for funding for the uninsured, because right now they're the chief beneficiaries.
Because they've got contracts that give them better-than-average health care there.
Exactly. So they would face some higher tax bite from that. And my hope is that because of the goals that we'd be achieving – health coverage for everyone, a living wage for every full-time worker, great schools for poor kids, et cetera, that even those people in the interest that would have to give up a little would say that it's worthwhile to achieve these kind of goals that make for a better country.
Well, Bill, maybe there's a start on enough pain for you, for the progressive observer of the idea here. Kate's calling from Boston. Hi, Kate. You're on the air.
Hi. I think my point actually might echo what the last caller said, which is I'm wondering where the social solidarity piece comes in this question. It seems to me that conservative politics, as I see it through my liberal rose-colored glasses, gives a lot of lip service to things like educating poor children and having living wages for working families, but doesn't actually do a lot to make that a possibility.
So are you saying, how do you really get people from across the spectrum actively engaged behind big solutions like this?
Yes.
Well, there's a question. Matt Miller.
I have a couple of answers. One is, the first thing is that there has to be, on the side that's opposing the current Republican policies, there just has to be a much bigger level of ambition. As I said, since 1994, the Democrats have been unwilling to think big again. And our system works like any dialectic. If you don't have the left pushing and the right pushing back, you don't end up with a center that's where it needs to be, in my view, for this country around these basic goals. But beyond that, I think we have to, what we have to do is build a constituency, not just among liberals in the country, but among people who are willing to look at common sense ideas, who are, call themselves Republicans or independents or anything. George Bush knows the reason George Bush campaigned in a way very different than the Newt Gingrich persona mm-hmm. is that people in the center of American politics want someone who's compassionate. In my view, a lot of President Bush's compassion is demonstrably a kind of a hoax. And we need to create a real constituency for real policies and real answers that would do this. Because remember, politicians will respond to lead any parade that forms. And we have to, as citizens, develop the kind of better followership, if you will, that makes the kind of better leadership we have possible. There's more information on how people can get involved, by the way, Tom, at www.2%solution.com to try and create across the spectrum the kind of constituency for real answers we need.
So, Matt, Lawrence Kolakoff, please.
Why don't you run for president? We got it. You know, everybody else does. Why don't you do it?
Well, maybe governor of California first. Everybody's certainly doing that. But we got a book in front of us right now and an idea right here. Lawrence Kolakoff, I wonder, you expressed skepticism about this consensus across party lines. Matt's saying, let's build it around common sense, and that politicians, even George W. Bush, understand very well that there's a kind of middle ground, a common sense ground that's appealing to people. But is it appealing enough to really pull together this highly polarized political scene?
Oh, I think it is. I think if we could get somebody on the Democratic, you know, one of these candidates to articulate Matt's proposals here, he'd sound like a new Democrat or she'd sound like a new Democrat and maybe carry the day. I don't think that the American, you know, I think the American public basically would agree with the goals that Matt is articulating. And there's why, so.
But isn't the big government label going to be hung around the neck of any politician who stands up and proposes this?
Well, you know, if you say it's self-financing, you're going to do it from reducing corporate welfare or eliminating the subsidies to people that don't deserve them, really. Then you don't necessarily sound so, I think, you know.
Doesn't sound like big government, maybe.
Yeah, I think that we do need fresh ideas and focus on the fundamentals. And we're stuck. You know, unfortunately, we all expected Clinton to pull all this off, but he was just a disaster, as Pat, I think, would be the first to say. And Bush is even worse on actually getting to deal with these problems. We need some grown-ups to actually run the country.
Matt Miller, we've just got half a minute left. Why isn't this happening? Why aren't the candidates out there right now making proposals like this?
Again, I think it's because there's been a moratorium on ambition for too long because the Democrats have felt cowed since the demise of the Clinton health care plan. I do think there's a chance between leaders and elites getting engaged, your own listeners getting involved in creating a constituency for a movement that can make the world safe for our politicians to do the right thing. I mean, that is the job of the citizen in a democracy, to inform themselves a bit, for the press to spread the word, and to make it clear that we actually can solve these problems that seem intractable and have a better country for it.
Well, citizens, there's a poke in the ribs from Matt Miller. His new book is The 2% Solution, Fixing America's Problems in Ways Liberals and Conservatives Can Love. Matt Miller, thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
And Lawrence Kolakoff, chair of the economics department at Boston University, thank you for being with us as well.
Yeah, my pleasure.
In a moment, a radio postcard from Lourdes, France. This is On Point. When 20-year-old Sarah Seltzer visited Lourdes, France this summer, she got a lot more than she bargained for. This college junior was there on business, researching the city and its famous Catholic shrine for a travel guide. Then something happened. Despite being a self-described agnostic, Seltzer was moved to tears by the stream of pilgrims coming to the shrine. In this radio postcard, she explains why.
I must be the only New York City Jew for hundreds of miles, I think, as I walk down the street towards the famous grotto in Lourdes, France, one of the world's most visited Catholic pilgrimage sites. where in the mid-19th century, St. Bernadette is said to have had a vision of the Virgin. After a restless overnight train, I am armed with my notebook and my press pass, ready to be fascinated, repelled, and intrigued. I'm not ready to cry. But an hour later, I'm sitting on the pavement, and I've seen a parade of sick, disabled, and blind, young and old, being wheeled or prodded towards the grotto to receive their blessing. Hearing poignant organ music in the background and operating on little sleep, I have been robbed of self-control. My sobs come in big, hiccuping gulps that I hide as best I can beneath my sunglasses. The Catholics around me, afflicted by disease and sadness, have faces full of hope, while they clutch the wheelchairs of elderly, infirm parents in one hand and their rosaries in the other. They are thinking only of the good that religion might do. Only I am moved to cry, the agnostic backpacker who thinks of French Catholicism as a long tradition of killing Huguenots, persecuting Jews, and building gorgeous cathedrals on the backs of peasants. In order to rescue myself from the terror of pure feeling, I decide to analyze my tears. My pragmatic, journalist side is upset and angered by the futility of some of these pilgrimages, particularly those of the parents who have brought mentally disabled children here. Holy water doesn't stop cancer, chemotherapy does, and a $3 bar of soap in the shape of the Virgin Mary won't do much in the way of healing birth defects. But my emotional, aesthetic side is completely struck by the wonder of the scene, by the music echoing from the giant underground basilica, by the way people's hands lovingly stroke the rocks of the grotto, by the sense of hope and faith in the humid July air. Theirs is a hope and faith that leaves me out of the loop, because there's a part of me that would love, and I mean love, to be able to ditch my skepticism, get down on my knees, and pray my heart out. Damn it, religion is so beautiful. It's not just the beauty in the stained glass of churches, the golden domes of mosques, or the embroidered Torah scrolls. It's in the faces of believers, illuminated by a mix of comfort and ecstasy. They are seeing into another world. They belong. But religion is also terrible. These people whose faces I now watch in awe, I can't help thinking that their ancestors confined mine to squalid, unlivable ghettos, or watched in silence as the cattle cars rolled out towards Auschwitz. And there's no need to list the places in today's world where people continue to kill in the name of God. I'm in a tizzy about it all, so I'm happy to leave the site to meet Devin, an American I met on the night train, for dinner. Over a beer, we joke about the nuns, the souvenir shop selling Jesus holograms, the obvious lack of nightlife. But despite our levity, we decide to go back and watch the candlelight procession in front of the church, where we hear Hail Mary in French, English, Spanish, Italian, and German, and see pilgrims marching with candles held high. Devin is part Catholic, and a little unsteadily, he whispers the prayer to himself. "We can leave if you want," he says after a while. "No, no, no, we'll leave whenever you want," I say. So we stay around until the end. I'm just thankful he's here. His presence prevents my being alone and vulnerable to another crying fit. The next day, we take a bus to the Pyrenees. Devin to hike into Spain, me to research at the foot of glaciers. When I come back to Lourdes a few days later to finish my work, I have no thunderous emotional reaction. Lourdes is old hat, and I'm all business. I check off addresses and check out new restaurants. Finally, I'm ready to leave. At the train station, I meet two American women from Boston who flew all the way here to pray for a sick relative. As the train lurches forward, one pulls out her rosary and whispers a prayer. I turn away. But I'm thankful that I've seen her, and that I've seen Lourdes. Even though I've had no vision, and drawn no conclusion, I know I haven't passed through this holy ground unchanged.
Sarah Seltzer is a junior at Harvard University. She hails from New York City. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Support for this program comes from Soft.